Welcome to this special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and today we're focusing on food. Coming up this hour, it's been a tough few years for farmers who produce and sell food through community-supported agriculture, or CSAs. We're going to talk to a few of them later in the hour. Back in March of last year, I sat down with food writers and radio hosts Monica Ng from WBEZ Chicago and Louisa Chu from the Chicago Tribune. Both of them co-host the podcast Chewing, and they both also grew up in Chicago in the world of Chinese restaurants. As you'll hear in a minute, both Monica and Louisa's family owned and operated Chinese restaurants, and both journalists wrote pieces about their food heritage for the Chicago Tribune. I wanted to invite them to sit down to eat at a quintessential Chinese-American spot to talk about different styles of Chinese cuisine, whether or not chop suey is authentic, and of course, what makes a good egg roll. Here we are at Lee's Chop Suey, which opened in 1968 in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. What are we going to get?
Well, I'm thinking definitely some chop suey, chow mein, egg foo young, and maybe even sweet and sour pork. What do you guys think?
I for sure need to get the egg rolls because they are the classic, what I'm calling Chicago-style Midwestern egg rolls with peanut butter in the ingredients. Fried shrimp for sure, which I'm guessing is going to be like the sort of puffy, breaded Cantonese fried shrimp. So far, those are my main things, but yeah.
Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, so you have regular egg roll, three of it, one vegetable egg roll, and one shrimp fried rice, and one ground corn, which is the six pieces, mushroom egg foo young, and one shrimp fried rice, which is small size, and one chicken chow mein, which is a crispy one, and also the Chinese chop suey. So the egg foo young is mushroom egg foo young.
So, all right.
Okay.
That be all?
I think that's a lot of food.
Okay. All right.
So Monica Ng and Louisa Chu are here. Can both of you share, Monica, do you want to start the story of your family's Chinese restaurant in Chicago?
Sure. Actually, my great-grandpa, Joe Ng, came to Quincy, Illinois, which has been in the news lately, in about 1909. He had laundries there and then came to Chicago and started opening restaurants. He had some takeout joints in East Garfield Park, as well as a giant, world's largest Chinese cafe called the Golden Pumpkin, also in East Garfield Park, where he had jazz bands and three stories of restaurants until 1929, and he lost it all in the Great Depression and started up again in 1933 with Hosai Gai, House of Ang, a bunch of other restaurants in the Chicago area and Chicago.
Louisa, what about your family?
So can I first say that Monica always seems to downplay the fact that her family's restaurants were a dynasty, that she is a descendant, albeit perhaps undeserving, of this incredible restaurant dynasty. Hosai Gai was unlike and perhaps will be unlike any other Chinese restaurant in history. It was this spectacular Art Deco masterpiece, which the building was completely torn down, is now Daley Plaza here in Chicago. And you can still see pictures of postcards online. I mean, and they each had themed rooms, each one which was more exquisite than the other. Later on, the Empire included some of the most spectacular, also tiki cocktail restaurants, which had one of the restaurants had one of the first Asian key clubs, which were modeled after the Playboy rooms of a different era.
Basically, you could be entertained by women,
right.
Very beautiful women. Mm. One of our restaurants was pretty much two doors down from the Playboy Club on Walton. And my relatives were seeing these long lines outside the Playboy Club and saying, hey, why not have some gorgeous ladies at our place, too? So we had Hung Fa Village, which specialized in that. We had the key clubs in the House of Angs, too.
So we're at Lee's Chop Suey. What kind of style Chinese restaurant would you characterize this as?
Rec room. This
old school.
This is like late 1960s, 1970s era dark wood paneling rec room kind of, you know, with
red lanterns, yep. Chinese art.
Can you explain what Cantonese style restaurants would be like?
So my family restaurants were chop suey, Cantonese style chop suey, which really came around during the same time that these did, you know, late 1960s, 1970s, where they served some of the classic mid-century modern chop suey, chow mein, Hong Kong steak. also then started to add in, though, pan-fried noodles, because that was actually sort of a more, I should say, late-era Cantonese introduction to Chicago-style Midwestern Chinese restaurants. Mild sauces, it is generally...
Not to be confused with mild sauce on Chicago's south side that you get in places like Harold's. Different.
Completely different, but...
Oh, well, or a tea's coming. And then Lazy Susan is a must. We have a Lazy Susan in the middle of the table.
The Chinese chop suey, which is the barbecue pork mixed with the vegetables.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you. Everyone needs hot tea on a cold night like tonight.
So there's actually a little bit of an evolution, too, because these chop suey restaurants really did start out by serving Chinese American but Cantonese style food, whereas now there's now a next generation of Cantonese style food, which is serving foods that you will find in the southern coastal region of Guangdong, previously known as Canton, and Hong Kong style food. So, for example, in Chicago, Ming Hin is a restaurant that serves Cantonese kai or chai. Also in Chinatown serves what I call fancy Cantonese, with these big banquet rooms and dim sum, and you know, so
elaborate
there's
seafood dishes.
Yeah, where they have like the 26 course Lunar New Year meals.
Abalone. Mm-hmm.
So would you consider, and I don't know if this is the right word, do you consider this authentic, or what word would you use?
Well, there's been a lot of debate over that. And what I say is, when a cuisine's been around for more than, let's say, 115 years, it's a real cuisine. Is it exactly what our ancestors ate in Canton? Probably not.
It's really hard. We actually just published a guide to Chinatown, and I addressed the question of authentic, because we know what people mean, and I wrote about that and said, you know, I know what you mean, and for lack of a better word yet, we're going to use authentic, you know, but yeah.
So by authentic, we mean not American? Is that what that's what people mean when they say authentic?
They don't want
things that have an American style or influence?
When I hear authentic, I think this is what people from this country ate back home.
But I think that it's such a broad general term when it comes to food. I mean, it's like there's authentic African-American food, which is clearly of this country and was nothing like, or actually very little like African food, but it's clearly a cuisine that is of this country. And as far as time is concerned, I mean, we have now a lot of dishes that were created here that have a shorter lifespan. I mean, I think about like sort of a lot of the mashups, like Mexican snack foods and street foods, which were developed out of a lot of the, you know, street foods and bodegas here in the U.S. So authentic is a tough one, you know. I don't know. We don't know what the better word is for that, but like real, genuine, authentic, we know what you mean. I have a tough time with what's authentic or not.
But if you're asking, is this what people ate in Canton before they left? Nope, not what we ate. Let's say with egg rolls. I did a story for the Tribune about these chubby cabbage and shrimp and pork plus peanut butter egg rolls. And I asked my great aunt, Fanny Goh, is this the kind of thing you ate when you were in Canton? She said there was nothing like this there. If you had anything sort of like it, it was the spring roll, a thin little delicate roll that they would serve during the spring festival, also known as Chinese New Year.
The egg rolls are coming.
Speak of the devil, here they are. Look at these gorgeous, blistered, golden, chubby things. All right, and the sauces. So usually in the United States, you get sweet and sour sauce plus a mustard sauce made with Coleman's English mustard. How Cantonese is that? Well, because the British were in China.
Thank you.
Oh, what is that?
Oh, that's a fried shrimp.
Oh, that's a shrimp. They look like little donuts.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay. And this is
the crab rangoon.
Yes.
Okay. Sauce. So this is, I feel like, our fried course has come. Who wants to tell us history of where egg rolls came from then?
Okay, so you don't see egg rolls on menus until, I'd say, mid-century. And actually, it was thought that these types of egg rolls were created in New York and then came here. Louisa likes to refer to them as Midwest style. I don't know. But what you see in China is something called a spring roll, much more slender and delicate with a thinner wrapper, served at the Spring Festival, also known as Lunar New Year. Crab Rangoon, 1956, Trader Vic's. I recently had someone tell me that he invented it in Saginaw, Michigan in the 70s, but you can't full historical documents. Trader Vic's was one of the tiki restaurants that grew up out of the post-World War II era when all the GIs were coming home. They'd been exposed to Polynesia and South Pacific. The musical had come out, and everybody was thinking about these exotic girls and these exotic umbrella drinks. And so my great uncle and my grandfather opened up a restaurant on Randolph right next to the Oriental Theater called South Pacific. Trader Vic's was a restaurant in the Palmer House.
Did everybody try the egg roll?
Not yet.
Louisa.
I know.
They wanted to come up with all of these exotic dishes. So they had these flaming dishes, these poo-poo platters, and crab rangoon was one of the dishes that came out of it, and it sounds very, very exotic.
All right, I'm gonna try the egg roll first.
What's the verdict?
What's the verdict? It's a good one. I like how the strands of cabbage still have a little bit of crunch in them. Sometimes some of the newer ones are completely really fine cut or almost a paste in the middle. A pretty good fry in these. Really nice distinctive savory tone from the peanut butter, which is noticeable but not too overwhelming. I've had
Why peanut butter?
Nyla, that is the eternal question.
You said this is the 12th egg roll you've had in the past week.
Actually, this might be the 12th place. So I've had a lot of egg rolls.
How far have you gone in this egg roll quest? Where have you gone?
So far, the biggest trip that I took on hitting the egg roll trail, I went out west and drove about 200 miles round trip out to DeKalb and Rockford. In DeKalb, there's a restaurant called Pho and Grill. And then in Rockford, there is a restaurant called Lung Fung Number 2. It's very important to distinguish that it's the number 2 in Rockford. And both of those restaurants have egg rolls that are descendants of the Pekin House restaurant in Chicago on Devon Avenue, closed in 2012, I believe it was. One of the two sort of most beloved long-lost egg rolls in the Chicago area. Very different, though. Pekin House was closer to the egg rolls here at Lee's, which is more sort of like the classic golden, somewhat the similar style of the familiar tubular Chinese American appetizer, whereas Cow Cow was very different because it was batter dipped before it was double fried.
And then you were explaining why peanut butter?
So that's the big existential question. Why is there peanut butter? It is this question about cultural identity. I've heard a lot of different theories, some that peanut butter was used to seal the wrappers, others that it was used as a binding ingredient, that it was a filler during World War II rationing time, and others simply because it was just for flavoring. So I tracked down the man that I thought invented the Chinese American, what I call the Chicago style egg roll of peanut butter, and can't tell you yet, Nyla. I'm sorry.
You just heard some of the conversation I had with Louisa Chu and Monica Ng over dinner back in March at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago. We'll share some pictures of our meal over social media and on our website, 21stshow.org. We'll be back in a minute here with more of this conversation on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Hi, Nyla. My name is Barbara. I heard you were doing a show on Chinese food, and I graduated from the U of I, and when I go back there to visit, I always like to go to Bobo China. I really enjoy the Mongolian lamb and their stir-fried beef with the rice noodles. Thanks a lot. Great show. Bye.
Hi, my name is Matthew from Bloomington, Illinois, and I'm calling about my favorite Chinese restaurant, the Orient Gourmet. I think it is classic Chinese food done really well. Their crab rangoon is my go-to appetizer. The beef with broccoli is my go-to main dish. And just about everything else is really, really good. So I'm recommending the Orient Gourmet. Thanks and great show.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, we're bringing you a conversation I had with Chicago Tribune food writer Louisa Chu and WBEZ reporter Monica Ng. These two know their Chinese food and their Chinese-American history, so I invited them out to eat with me at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago's Northwest Side. We're going to tweet out links to articles that Monica and Louisa have written out, but let's get back to our conversation.
This is the crispy noodle. This is supposed to go on top of the chop suey?
So traditionally, that is the old school. The good thing is that that's the old school chow mein noodles, and people will recognize it as being like I was saying, looks like fried pieces of spaghetti.
Louisa, do you know the difference between Chinese chop suey, fine cut chop suey, and regular chicken chop suey?
I've never had chop suey or egg fuya.
I'm guessing that the fine cut pork chop suey is going to be different than like what is considered a classic American or Midwestern style pork chop suey, which is like usually chunks. So like the really classic old school mid-century modern chop suey was chunks of pork and celery.
Actually, chop suey was served in all of the cafeterias of downtown Chicago at the beginning of the 20th century. Fritzl's had it. Basically every cafeteria in a school would serve chop suey every week. It was a very American thing.
Right, but the thing is, I'm not sure that that chop suey was similar to the mid-century chop suey because, you know, so
was that just cabbage and meat?
Celery and meat and bean sprouts.
Chop suey can mean so many different things, and that's kind of what is sort of delightful about it, is that it is conceptually pretty amazing and pretty ingenious and inventive. As far as how they make it here, we'll have to find out.
I am happy to be both Chinese and American.
You are like the Chinese dish the Americans invented. What do they call it?
Chop suey.
That is it. Everything is in it, all mixed up.
I like that. Chop suey, chop suey. Living here is very much like chop suey. Hula hoops and nuclear war, Dr. Salk and Shah Rukh Gabor, Bobby Darin, Sandra Dee and Dewey. Chop suey, chop
suey. So now I'm trying my first egg foo young.
So actually, I just wrote a mushroom egg foo young and mushroom gravy recipe for the Trib, which I'm very relieved that a lot of people wrote in and said that they were excited to try it and made it and really loved it because it does hit a very specific, again, taste memory. So typically, egg foo young can be traced back to, again, we think the Canton, Guangdong region of southern coastal China, which I should add is, I often say it's kind of like the New Orleans area of the U.S. and has a reputation as having some of the best food in China. And you'll find actually variations of egg foo young, this kind of omelet or frittata, if you will, throughout Asia. It's not just a Chinese-American thing. You'll find it in other hybrid Cantonese Asian foods. And so typically in Chinese-American restaurants, the way we used to make it is that you mixed your ingredients together. Typically, the main ingredients were egg and bean sprouts. And then in a ladle, lowered into a big, deep, hot wok full of oil, and then it would bubble up. It bubbles up like a souffle. Then it gets all crispy and golden brown in the outside, but should still stay a little tender on the inside. And then the gravy, my recipe, which actually is at the Trib, it's super easy. And so basically what you take is either fresh shiitake or portobello mushrooms, which are really common now, which was not so common in the mid-century or late mid-century foods when these came up. And you saute those first. You season as you go along, you taste them. You add fresh bean sprouts and some egg, some scallions. You whip that up until it's frothy. And then in the bottom of a round bottom wok, you add, you know, a fair amount, like maybe 3 tablespoons or so of like either coconut oil or peanut oil, and then you let it bubble up and fry until it gets all nice and lacy and crispy around the edges. And then when it just barely sets on the bottom, you flip it over. And so it's not necessarily the round puffed patty that a lot of restaurants will achieve because they have the benefit of the big, giant, deep woks full of oil. But I could not reasonably ask people to put like 2 gallons of oil or so into a wok. So you can do this actually with just like, a round bottom wok, or I heard back from people who use like an electric skillet, just use a fair amount of oil and then you just flip it. And then also the gravy, and it's just simply a matter of seasoning enough with salt, pepper, soy sauce, and really not much more else. And it just makes a huge difference. Salt just makes a huge difference. It's really not that much more. Mine isn't so much necessarily a classic roux as much as it is a flour-based sauce rather than a cornstarch-based sauce. So mine again starts with sautéed mushrooms and then some flour, and also then a little additional fat in the form of either, again, coconut oil or peanut oil. Then that is essentially your roux base for your sauce, and then you add vegetable stock into it, and then you mix that up, and then you will have a little bit of like a slightly chunky mushroom-flecked gravy, and it's just a really simple sauce.
Chow mein and bowling, Twinkies and champagne, moon over McDonald's, frozen pizza in the rain.
Okay, here's my question, Monica. You wrote a story recently for the Chicago Tribune. We've been here talking. We're at a Chinese restaurant. We're enjoying the food. You wrote a really interesting story about the history of how, even though Chinese restaurants are more common, there's 3 times more Chinese restaurants in the U.S. than there are McDonald's. I learned that by reading your story.
Yes.
At one point in time, that almost was not the case, and it was because Chicago tried to outlaw them.
Yeah, there was a group of strange bedfellows, labor unions that represented servers and bartenders, and Chicago legislators and state legislators across the nation were kind of freaked out by all the Chinese in the United States. And Chinese restaurants also weren't unionized. So they actually got some legislation pretty far. I mean, it was passed that would outlaw white women from entering Chinese restaurants, that would forbid restaurant licenses to anybody who wasn't who couldn't be naturalized, and Chinese could not become citizens, so basically no Chinese restaurants, and that would stop Chinese from, say, opening restaurants or even doing any construction in certain parts of Chicago.
And when was this?
We're talking about 1909-ish. Up until about 1915, all these things were pretty much going strong.
People don't realize that's actually the origin of American immigration law, was to bar Chinese people from coming to this country. Those were like the first immigration laws that were ever passed in this country.
Right. I mean, there was this big yellow peril. There was this big scare about how many Chinese were coming here. So I had no idea that at the time, Chinese restaurants were considered a scandalous place. Going out on a chop suey date and going to a chop suey restaurant was considered akin to like going
scandalous?
To a rave. I talked to UC Davis law professor Gabriel Jack Chin, who you actually met, Nyla.
Yeah, I did. I met him in Champaign.
And he told me that it was a place of freedom, a place where women who were about to get the vote nationally, had already gotten in Chicago, felt like they did not have to necessarily follow the rest of the laws of society.
And they went to Chinese restaurants to do that?
Yes. So if you wanted to be free from the strict laws of society at that time, you went to a Chinese restaurant.
It just seems so crazy.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I mean, these are racist laws, basically saying that no Chinaman, quote unquote, could get a restaurant license, or that white women under the age of 21 years old couldn't enter one of these restaurants. Clearly, there was racism involved. But I do want to say that at the time, Chicago's Chinatowns were located near the Levee districts or the red light districts. And some of them did have ties to bars.
And there were a lot of Chinese gangs.
There were Chinese gangs, and opium was an issue in Chicago, not just in Chinese areas, but I will give that caveat. It didn't mean that you needed to bar any Chinese from ever getting a restaurant
license.
It didn't
mean that every chop suey restaurant was a drug haven.
Exactly. Although you can hear this sentiment when you listen to Louis Prima's song, Chop Suey Chow Mein, Tu Fu and You.
Chop suey chow mein, tu fu and you. I've got the craziest yen to get you in a Chinese den. where I can whisper love words full of spice after we get full of tea and rice. Chop suey, chow mein, tofu, and you. I've got a feeling tonight that we'll be pretty clever if we ever get together with chop suey, chow mein, rice and tea, shoes and rice, and you and me. Chop suey, chow mein, young one, tofu, and you.
But then, later in that century, in 1915, after tons of case law had been established, after tons of, and you know, there's this connection between the Chinese and the Jews, they love each other, but a lot of Jewish immigration lawyers had been working toward changing the rules about Chinese immigration. And there were four
categories.
Why? Well, because the Chinese wanted to keep coming in, and so they kept...
They were helping.
They were helping out. They were immigration lawyers. So there were four categories of people who would be allowed in under the Chinese Exclusion Act: students, diplomats, teachers, and merchants. But in terms of interpreting what a merchant meant, it was very, very loose. And initially, it did not include restaurant owners. But after tons of tries and after a lot of case law was established, finally in 1915, they established beyond a shadow of a doubt that a high-class Chinese restaurateur could gain entrance to the United States and actually go back and bring relatives, what would we call chain migration today.
But it was really expensive, quote unquote, yeah, chain migration.
Right. So you would have to show that you had a certain class of restaurant, and you had to have three white witnesses vouch for you, saying that you truly were the manager of the restaurant, that you did no menial tasks, you were not a worker.
And how much would it have cost in today's dollars to do this?
You know, I was seeing some estimates of about $100,000, $130,000
per restaurant.
Okay. And so I was also told that, you know, different immigration judges would be more lenient or less lenient depending on who you went to. But it was, you know, pretty much established you had to have a nice place or else you couldn't come in. And then, of course, you know, the three white witnesses rule that they had to vouch.
White men, I'm sure.
Right.
I'm sure it wasn't white women.
But once that happened, and once they said, okay, restaurateur is a category that will be let in and can go back and get workers, you saw a tripling of Chinese restaurants. Sometimes you saw a fivefold increase of Chinese restaurants in different communities. But you didn't want them all in the same community. So then you saw Chinese going to Oklahoma. I have some family who are out there, going to the South, going everywhere because you didn't want to have a ton of competition. So Chinese restaurants were spread out all over the United States, and everybody decided that they were a restaurateur now.
We didn't make a dent in this food. Not even, barely. It was good, though.
A lot of eggs young left for Louisa.
Thank you for a lovely dinner, Louisa Chu, Monica Ng. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Now it's time to finish this chop suey.
We're not going to finish it. Now it's time to pack it all up and take it home.
Take out boxes.
Special thanks to Monica Ng, Louisa Chu, and Lee's Chop Suey. Coming up after the break, how and why CSA farmers are having a hard time with their produce sales. Stay close, you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're hitting the tail end of summer here, and this time of year, if you bought shares from a community-supported agriculture or CSA farm, you're right in the middle of getting your fresh produce on a regular basis. CSAs allow consumers to buy produce directly from small farmers, but times are actually pretty hard for CSA farmers. The market's gotten a lot tougher in the past few years, and it's led CSA farmers to try and adapt in order to stay competitive. Shay Balahi is one of those farmers. She's part owner and manager of Blue Moon Farm in Urbana and in studio with me now. Simon Huntley's also with us. He's the founder and CEO of Harvey, a company that helps small farms with marketing and technology. Shay, Simon, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Shay, you first started this farm about seven years ago, and you've been with Blue Moon Farm since 2015. Choosing to go into farming is itself, I imagine, a pretty big decision, but why did you want to work on a CSA farm specifically?
So actually, when I joined Blue Moon Farm, they weren't a CSA farm. It was a program that I helped implement when I moved there. But I really like connecting directly with my customers and establishing a relationship, and find that that's the best way to help build community.
Mm-hmm. And so you brought some carrots with you today that look beautiful. What are you guys growing right now?
Right now, we are mostly growing inside of our greenhouses, which helps us be year-round. We've got spinach and salad mix, baby bok choy, some baby kale, some big kale, Swiss chard, collard greens, and we've got a lot of brassicas that we've planted by hand out in the field.
So I wonder how it's different if running a CSA farm versus a traditional farm where you are, and I imagine there are some farmers who probably do both, right?
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, CSA farm is a little bit different in that you have to plan to have something reliably for several different people every week. So you need a steady influx of product to supply to your consumers.
And how have the past few years been for you guys and for your business?
Pretty, you know, they're changing. It's changing overall for our farm. But we're doing pretty good. We're staying relative in the market. And we're staying connected with our community, which we find is the best way to stay within giving produce to our community is direct to the consumer.
And are you finding there are more competitors in your space now?
Definitely. The market has changed for sure. We're noticing a lot of bigger grocery stores that offer organics where before it wasn't as widely available. And the convenience factor changes how the market works for sure.
Mm. Simon, I wonder if you could explain a little bit more. You work with not just Shea, but other CSA farms across the country. Are we seeing this across the country increase competition in the local food market, essentially?
Yeah, it's definitely happening across the country. And Harvey has been developed by my company to help farms address these changes. And I really started to notice it 4, 5, 6 years ago. Certainly when I started being involved in CSA farms and the early 2000s, this is really the only game in town as far as getting local, sometimes organic, not always organic, but produce. And so that has really changed in the last 10, 15 years. And we're seeing that effect on our farms.
So what are the biggest challenges that farmers are telling you they need help with, Simon?
We just, it's really about keeping members year over year. So that's one thing that we look at is how farms can have really good retention rates and how can they make their customers happy. I mean, oftentimes they're growing great produce, right? And they have this great connection. Shea does a really good job of connecting to her community members. And so this is really a special thing that's out there. Like you're not going to get this at a grocery store. You're not going to get that connection to your farmer at the grocery store, but through a CSA farm or a farm share, you can do that. And so we just put a couple tools on top of that to make it customizable, nice payment plans, really good support, recipes, things like this. So we put this, just make it a little bit more customer friendly and let the farms do what they do. And they're really succeeding with it.
Mm-hmm. So Shay, you introduced us to Simon and to Harvey. What has Harvey done to help you guys?
Harvey's really been amazing to help us with the technology aspect, making it easy for our customers to sign up. But even better than that. It's allowing us to offer fully customized boxes to our consumers, to our customers, our farm shareholders. Over the last few years, when we reintroduced our CSA program on our farm, most of the feedback that we got from our customers is that they wanted more flexibility in what they got in their boxes. So the thing that Harvey does is allows every single customer to go in and rate all of our vegetables on a scale from 0 to 5 or 1 to 5 based on how much they like it. And then Simon's created this algorithm in the background that creates a box for the customers every week based on what they like. So they're not forced to eat beets if they don't like beets.
Which is kind of always, I would say, the common refrain with the CSA is when people get a box and there's stuff in there that either they don't know what to do with or they don't like.
Exactly. And Harvey also supplies recipes. So if you're stuck, you know, you've had tomato soup for the 1,000th time, you want a new way to use tomatoes, Harvey provides recipes for every box that is made for each customer.
And is that harder for you if you're customizing? Is that a challenge for you in terms of the growing side?
It is a little bit more challenging, but not really. We are really diverse on our farm, and we have a lot of different products. So we're able to put limits on, you know, if we only have 20 pounds of arugula, we can put a limit on that. And so it does make it a little bit easier, and it adds additional challenges in different ways.
Right. It sounds like so probably a lot of things you did not think you would be doing when you were getting into farming, right?
Yeah.
We're speaking with Shay Balahi with Blue Moon Farms in Urbana. Simon Huntley's on the line, founder and CEO of Harvey. That's a company that helps smaller farms with marketing and technology. And I want to introduce Guillermo Payet, founder and president of Local Harvest. That's a website and database for CSAs and for farmers markets. He's based in California in Santa Cruz. Hi, Guillermo. Thanks for being with us, too. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Guillermo, I wonder if you can respond to something Simon said about how kind of the competitive edge that CSAs have is thinking this is a chance for you to know your farmer. But I'm thinking about grocery stores now where they have people coming in and this is like a meet the farmer event, and they're trying to also, I think there's in the grocery store space, everyone is kind of recognizing the narrative and wanting to capitalize on people knowing their farmer. Are you seeing this happen all across the country that CSA farmers are having to compete with at this level?
Yes. We work with about 7,000 CSAs in the country, Local Harvest. We have a few hundred that use our CSA Ware service, which is a competitor to Harvey. And what we've seen also in the last few years is about 40% decline on the size of the CSA market. The entire CSA market, maybe 5 years ago, was around $400 million a year, not very big. Now, I think that the problem for CSAs is not so much the local grocery chains, which, I mean, they are actually kind of a little bit of a marketing venue where people can see the produce for a particular farm, and then if they know about the CSA from that farm, they can subscribe directly. But the main problem has been the meal kit companies. The meal kit companies.
So this is like the HelloFresh, Blue Apron, all of those kind of things.
Right.
Okay.
Those companies, their current market is about $1 billion a year. That's like three times as big as CSAs are right now, or more. And now they're doing that at a loss. Blue Apron was losing $100 million a quarter a year ago. Now they've managed to cut that down to something like $20 million a quarter, which is still pretty bad. I mean, they're losing money like crazy, but competing with CSAs, I mean, their whole marketing is very farmy, right? It's like they were created to capitalize on the CSA space that small farms had created. So that is the main thing that is hurting the small farms right now, the CSA farms. I mean, we've seen in Illinois, I mean, we work with 152 currently active CSAs in Illinois, in Local Harvest. The average share size is 65 subscribers, so it's not a big market, but still we've seen, at least we know of 8 CSAs that have gone under in Illinois in the last couple of years.
Mm.
Shay, I wonder if it's frustrating for you as a farmer to hear what Guillermo is talking about. You're talking about building community and wanting people to be connected with you as a local farmer, but then you may be seeing people who have interest in cooking their own food finally, but they're buying it from this big company that's obviously not a local company.
Yeah, so I think we kind of look at those. I mean, as he said, they're losing money. They're not sustainable. They can't keep doing working at a loss. The thing
they're just trying to capture your market share.
Exactly. The thing that we are benefiting from Blue Apron and HelloFresh is that people are learning to cook again, and their retention rate isn't that great. So what it does is it helps people get familiar with new vegetables and new things and be able to cook. And then once people fall out of that that HelloFresh or Blue Apron thing, it's easier for them to transition to CSAs, get the product, and be able to use it in a similar way, probably at a much cheaper cost. And there's a lot of waste, plastic waste that goes on with Blue Apron, and CSAs, we're able to limit that waste, which is a benefit that we have.
So when we think about that, Simon, how are you working with folks like Shay? I wonder what advice you have for other people in terms of trying to stay competitive and stay afloat in this space.
Yeah, it's tough. I think what Guillermo is saying about these meal kit companies, very true. One thing that I noted is that I think this has gone down a little bit, but Blue Apron was willing to spend $144 on marketing to acquire a single customer. And this was at the time when they went public. So one of the things I see as a problem within our sort of local farming community is that we don't really market ourselves really well. I mean, we have this great product, you know, that people really want. People do really want to support local farms. They want this really fresh product, but I think in many cases, people don't even know that these programs even exist. So I think that we need to get better at marketing within our community.
Right. And obviously, Shay, you are farming, so marketing is like a whole other job. Guillermo, I wonder what you want people to know about CSAs as we've been having this conversation. What do you want listeners and consumers to know?
Well, my hope is that eventually we're going to go back to the slow organic growth on the space that we used to have until 5 years ago. That would happen when this food 2.0.com bubble that we're seeing right now pops, which I think eventually will. Now, what we're seeing right now in terms of like farms that are doing well, I mean, we see a lot of farms that are shrinking in the size of their CSA, but we do work with a few that we see that are growing, and the two main things that we see on those is some are competing with the meal kit companies in terms of all the bells and whistles, convenience, customizability, all these things. And we provide the tools to do that as well. But then also we're seeing that a lot of CSAs are really retaining their markets really well or growing. Some are growing by just focusing on community, like Blue Moon. They bring up the idea and refresh that to their members that they are part of a food shed, that of a food community. It's not just buying food.
Right, it's not just the transaction of this, right, Shay? And that's what you said about the whole idea of community when we're thinking about Blue Moon Farms. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to thank Shay Balahi for being with me with Blue Moon Farms, Simon Huntley with Harvey, and Guillermo Pyatt with Local Harvest. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're also on Facebook. If you want to search there for the 21st, you can like us, and it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, send us an email, or remember our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website. That's 21stshow.org.
We've also got all of our past shows archived there. You can find us also most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.